Wednesday, December 30th, 2020, the worst year ever. Adios. It's 1:36 in the afternoon, and this is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record via Zoom throughout Chicagoland. I'm at the WGN Radio Studios, and you can hear me weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
I'm Eric Zorn, the clairvoyant columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
You guys always know what he's talking about when he does that.
What does clairvoyant mean?
Oh, I know you, because you're teasing your predictions, right, Eric?
I can see the future. Yes.
Before we get to that and some of the bigger national stories, let's do some local topics first. Just real quick to satisfy Austin, because he wants to talk about nothing but COVID. Our rate is up to 7.4% from 6.8%, but obviously below recent highs. So hooray for that, even though we're getting less vaccine than we thought, and it's not getting right away to the places maybe it should first go. Heather, what would you say generally?
It's really too early to know whether there's going to be a post-Christmas, post-New Year's bump. The city saw one after Thanksgiving of about 30%, it's not clear what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks. So in the back of my mind, I've sort of been thinking that we're not really going to know one way or the other until about mid-January. And by then, we will know whether there's been a holiday bump or surge. But there's no doubt that Illinois is in much better condition than a state like California, and is in a much better condition, and Chicago is in a much better condition than a city like Los Angeles. There's still a lot of COVID-19 out there. The city's test positivity is still above 8%, which was the level that Governor Pritzker set back in July to trigger rollback. So that's why we're still under restrictions in Chicago. The fact of the matter is that should be no more than 5%. 5% test positivity indicates that the virus is well controlled, and that we aren't anywhere close to that. And we haven't been anywhere close to that. But it is good news that today, for the first time since early October, the city dropped below 1,000 confirmed or probable cases of COVID-19. That is an encouraging mark, but it is tentative progress at best, depending on how many people gathered over Christmas and how many people will gather over New Year's.
A real weird number for me to get your head around is 1 in 1,000 people in this country have died from this now.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm quite alarmed by this emergence of this more virulent spread, the strain of the virus. That this is a case out in Colorado now. It started in the UK. And that it's much more easily transmissible. And so the optimism that I was feeling just a couple of weeks ago is kind of tempered by that.
Yeah.
I've been looking at projections as to how many deaths we're going to have in this country. And it seems like, you know, it's going to be somewhere around 700,000, which is more than twice what we have now. And we're starting to see these cases like this congressman-elect down in Louisiana, who's 41 years old, who died of it, that it's not, you know, we've known this all along, but I think we're going to see more and more cases of people who are younger and less obvious in terms of their comorbidities and their vulnerability to this. I have the feeling that President-elect Biden is correct, that we are really heading into a very dark winter.
Well, I just think we don't have a true, in my opinion, we don't have a true handle on what the numbers look like. Obviously, they're down from that high of, what were we at, 13% in October?
16% was the
16%.
High. Yeah.
So I don't know whether we have a handle right now on what those numbers are. We're coming off of a holiday weekend when not all the testing wasn't sort of at 100%. I don't think that we have a true handle on where we're at right now. It is lower for sure, but I am concerned about this sort of, I don't know, what are they calling it, a super virus? It's more transmissible. So what I think we're going to see in mid-January is we'll really have a true sense of whether people gathered. And I think that they did. Just in talking to people anecdotally, it feels like people sort of like, I'll be okay. We're going to gather for Christmas. It's Christmas. I don't know. That's where I get into sort of like, it could be a long, dark winter. I'm I'm sort of fearful about what this looks like.
Well, in terms of the new strain, what I'm optimistic about is that it seems that all evidence points to there's not evidence that the vaccine won't work on this new strand. And most of the experts say that the odds are good that the vaccine will work. And in terms of vaccine distribution, that has been one of the wins that are few and far between, I think, for Illinois. We're doing pretty well in terms of the volume of vaccines that we're distributing over the last week, which has been really encouraging. So the fact that vaccines are being distributed now and seemingly effectively in Illinois is great. And the fact that the new strain doesn't appear to be resistant to that vaccine is also great. So those are two optimistic notes.
Maybe it was in the Sun-Times that I thought I read that a criticism of the distribution has been that it's not going enough to healthcare workers in the South and West side. We've seen these much publicized distributions, right, of doctors getting it. And it started on the West side, but it's really been downtown and north. And maybe it needs to be more geographically centered in the communities that are hardest hit.
It was the Sun-Times that reported on the zip codes of the people getting the virus. And there's no doubt that the first doctors and nurses and healthcare workers who got the virus live in disproportionately white and wealthy areas of Chicago. But we don't know the race or ethnicity of the people who got the vaccine yet. So it's only sort of partial data. And the other thing is that these people got the Pfizer vaccine. So the Pfizer vaccine is the one that has to be stored in ultra cold and a freezer. So the only hospitals that could distribute that vaccine were the bigger hospitals, which are mostly where? Downtown and on the north side, because they have the ultra cold storage. It's a little bit of, you know, apples and oranges. But I think Austin is right that Illinois, at least to this point, is really a success story in terms of vaccine distribution. And we heard from Dr. Allison Arwady, the commissioner of the Department of Public Health this morning, that Chicago has actually managed to distribute 95% of the vaccine that it's gotten from the federal government into somebody's arm. And that is significantly better than really anywhere else in the nation in terms of big cities. It's significantly better than New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco. Yeah. So that's good news. I would try to put your minds a little bit at ease about this new strain of COVID-19. This was always going to happen. Viruses mutate. That's what viruses do. They are very good at figuring out how to survive and thrive. And there's no indication that even though this virus seems to be more transmissible, although that hasn't been proven yet, it doesn't appear to be more deadly. And like Austin said, it does respond to the vaccine. But there's no doubt that it is widespread in Colorado, and I would be very shocked if it wasn't somewhere in Chicago. But this was always going to happen, and I think it's really important that we realize that, and that this is not some sort of movie superbug that's going to come and wipe us all out.
I'm surprised to hear you say that it's not more transmissible, or that hasn't been established.
It has not been established.
That's my all my fears are rooted in exactly that. Things I've heard over and over again.
And even if it is, the only way to stop the virus's transmission is what we've been told to be doing all along: wear a mask, wash your hands, and keep your distance. So where are you,
Heather, on this 700,000 figure, which is, like I said, I read a bunch of sites where people are making sort of guesses about where this is going to go. Do you think we're going to stay under 700,000 deaths?
I think it's very possible that we won't, actually. I mean, I think the scariest thing is, for me personally, is what is happening in Los Angeles, where they're running out of oxygen supplies for patients, and that they're putting patients like in gift shops. Their hospitals are so overwhelmed. And I think that it's really important to understand that what happened in Los Angeles could easily happen in Chicago, could easily happen again in New York. It could trigger just a huge wildfire. I think 700,000 deaths is probably more likely than not.
Did you all watch the movie The Andromeda Strain?
Yes.
A long time ago.
And as I recall, the very last scene, it's like, okay, humanity survives. We figured it out. And then the very last scene is womp, 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 womp. And you see this thing replicating or mutating. And you go, oh, crap, here we go again. That's the way I felt all week, Eric. I thought, oh, crap. just when the Pfizer thing is rolling out, womp womp, here comes a new version of it.
Yeah, there was a feeling that I had not too long ago that we had turned the corner. We're still going to be in a really, really dark winter, and I think I was sort of hoping that maybe we're about half done with this. A question that I asked in my news prediction poll was whether you think we're going to be back to normal indoor dining in Chicago by August 1st. And my guess was no.
I have moved my rolling date from July 18th at 11:45 a.m. to now July 25th at 7 p.m. is when I'm sounding the all clear horn. So I have backed it off a week in light of this news, but just a week. And part of that was, by the way, predicated on the fact that I got a whooping cough shot the other day. And so to get vaccinated for whooping cough and tetanus, a booster, the whole process took about 20 minutes from the time I walked up to the lady at the Walgreens to walk out of the little booth we were in, that emergency care room. You know, you have to roll up your sleeve. They do the cotton swab. I mean, literally every tiny little step takes time. And so for me to get a whooping cough shot took about 20 minutes. So I said, okay, what if that was the vaccine? And then I divided by 12.6 million people in Illinois. And say we have 1,500 people whose job Monday through Saturday is nothing but give people the shot. How long would it take? And dang, it's going to take a long time for everybody to get a shot. Even the best case scenario is going to require us to be more patient, I guess, than some of us want to be.
But you got to think about, in terms of the virus, right? A huge part of the spread and the exponential growth of any pandemic, but many pandemics, and especially this one, comes from super spreaders. So if you have, you know, a majority of super spreaders getting the virus, or a majority of people like essential workers who are interacting with a lot of people on a day-to-day basis getting it, you actually have kind of an exponential downward effect on the virus, just as you would an upward effect when it's spreading.
Yeah. Well, I saw Jim Jordan said, what would the founding fathers do about this? They wouldn't tell us to stay indoors. The founding fathers would embrace the economic side. Let's keep businesses open and let the virus be damned. And then a whole bunch of history professors online said, no, actually, they did have smallpox in Boston. They did shut the city down. They did practice social distancing. And that's how they beat it without medicine that we have today.
Well, John, history professors may say one thing, but Jim Jordan says another. So
let's talk about Chicago for just a second. I don't know that this is why is this story sort of percolating right now? But there is a pending ordinance to change the name of Lakeshore Drive from Lakeshore Drive to Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable Drive. I have a way to score these things. Rather than decide on the sort of virtue of the idea of giving it to du Sable, because that's all good by me, let's give them something or transfer something. It's not like we don't have several things named after du Sable in Chicago anyway. If you're going to change the name of something, then that thing must be the problem. I don't think Mr. Lakeshore did anything wrong. Since the Lakeshores were good, I don't think we need to punish them. Like, if you want to tear down a statue because somebody's a Nazi sympathizer or they were a slaveholder, I have no quorum with that, problem with that. You all figure that out. But the Lakeshores didn't do anything. So why are we picking on them?
I kind of agree with you, although I can't believe you forgot about the whole Me Too scandal about Lake Michigan. But I think it's kind of a free spot. Like if you're looking at a bingo card, right?
Yes.
It's like in the middle, it's like Lakeshore Drive. And right. And this is just like open season. If you're going to name it after anyone, he's a pretty good one to name it after. I would say it's better than like a mayor or something, which is what Chicago typically does. Not to dismiss this ordinance entirely, but this is the level of discourse that we usually see in city council, unfortunately. Like, is this the top of the list, most important thing that we really need to be talking about right now in our legislative body is whether to rename Lakeshore Drive? I don't think so. I don't think it's even in the top 50.
50. Yeah. I was going to say not 5, not 10. You're going maybe not even 49, huh?
Austin, you're forgetting about the needs of talk radio hosts.
I know. I completely agree with
that's
everything.
30 through 50. Yeah.
My agenda is so different, though, than I'm not a legislative body.
I tend to agree with you, John, about this. I like how evocative the name Lakeshore Drive is and where it is. I would like maybe we could rename Millennium Park or someplace, something that's significant. I mean, obviously you could change Balbo or something to DeSable, but you want something significant and large. And
you don't like Millennium Park?
It doesn't, you know, it wasn't even finished at the Millennium, right? I mean, I would just, you know, I think there are certainly places that you could rename, streets you could rename, Western Avenue, maybe, if you wanted to, although that would require people changing their addresses. But there are a lot of significant thoroughfares and places to rename. There's something just beautiful about the name Lakeshore Drive, the fact that it isn't, that it just, it evokes a sense of place. There's the song, you know, that people like. I guess I'm not really a sentimentalist about all this stuff, but I like Lakeshore Drive. I think that name should stay.
Well,
Alderman Zorn has weighed in.
Where do you guys score the Sun-Times story? They identified 36 Chicago public schools that are named after former slave owners or slave traders. And there's a group that wants to explore renaming those schools. Again, I don't have a problem with that.
They've already done that, right? There was a school. There's been a bunch of stories about Heidi Stevens has written about it. I'm blanking on
Agassiz.
Yeah, that's right. I guess I don't have any problem with that. I'm curious about what Aldermans Donovan and Sharon think about Lakeshore Drive.
I guess I don't understand why Lakeshore Drive is so sacred, a name that we can't think about renaming it for the first non-native settler. I guess that is also a point that sort of I'm trying to get my head around too. Sort of, are we going to name it for somebody, the first person who settled this area, or are we going to go back and look at who was here first and perhaps honor and make some things right that way?
I ranted today on the radio about the Cubs trading away Yu Darvish. And we don't normally talk about sports on this podcast. It's not because I'm a Cubs fan, but more because it reflects to me the fans be damned attitude that the Cubs organization has these days. Sting from the marquee network fee is not going to go away anytime soon. That the team allowed the field to be used as a fundraiser for the president is obviously divisive to half the fans, at least. Losing popular players and even a respected broadcaster to Sox Radio, for crying out loud, was just weird. And then Yu Darvish, who finally starts to pay dividends for this team and the fans loved, they signaled to the fans that, yeah, we think we're not going to be real good this year. So we're just going to, we're not going to be as competitive as we could be. I think it's just so dismissive. It's like you have a fan base. People have an affection for a team and the players. And the team seems to be the least in that camp. They don't seem to care about the players or the affection the fans have. They seem to care so little about the fans. On a year when you're so going to be waiting for baseball, the Cubs are telling in the winter their fans, yeah, we're not going to be there so much. So I went on a little rant about that today. Eric, do you agree with me on that?
Yeah, I do. I thought that it was a very strange trade. They got rid of Kyle Schwarber earlier, and they may be trying to get rid of Chris Bryant, who's very popular. It just feels like a white flag trade, doesn't it? And all the stories talk about how this gives them room under the salary cap. And evidently, I didn't study all the prospects that they got for Darvish. They got a pitcher and some prospects. But a lot of the reporting is that the Cubs got had in this trade.
You know how old the prospects are? 17, 18, 18, 20, and one other. Maybe these will be great trades. I mean, who cares?
Yeah, I mean, we could save this tape and in 10 years play it back and go, listen to these mincing rascals bagging on the greatest players in Cubs history. It's possible, but right now it really has a feel of their surrendering this season. I mean, even if these prospects turn out to be great, they're not going to be great this coming season.
Or next year.
Jed Hoyer gave a big press conference, and I did a sort of a gasp of breath when I heard him say, you know, that we're coming, that basically the Cubs was coming to the end with the group of players that won the 2016 World Series. And I think that's, you know, sort of an objective fact at this point. But it made me sad because, you know, I certainly never expected to see a Cubs World Series in my lifetime. And I guess I sort of bought into the hype that this was going to be a team that was going to, you know, bring multiple World Series championships to Chicago. And this, they were going to be perennial sort of challengers, and that, you know, Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant were going to, you know, statues of them were going to replace the lions at the Art Institute as we, you know, made them our new local overlords. But it's sad to see that come to an end just from a point of civic pride. But perhaps we are returning to the normal order of thing, and the rift in the time and space continuum that allowed the Cubs to win the World Series is being mended, and there's an indication of more calm days in the future.
Yeah, so it feels
like
the
resident White Sox fan here on the panel. What happened? That was a long way to get there, Heather. I was exactly what happened. My God, you would think that like the Pope died. I think this is exactly what happened, only more quickly after the White Sox won. All of a sudden, it was sort of like, okay, we paid all this money for these guys to be here, and then they sort of just dispersed everybody. It's the longstanding problem in Major League Baseball, right? They don't allow us, the fans, to have some time with the people that draw us in, sort of these players that we get to know and their personalities and all that stuff. So that's where it's at. And this has been going on for decades.
The Cubs did, with a lot of those players, win the World Series 4 years ago. So it's not like the next year they blew it up. And the team has won. They've been a successful team since 2016. They just haven't gotten back to the World Series. So I think that's been frustrating for a lot of fans. But I think we were going into this season thinking that we will be a playoff team. We'll win more than half our games. Who knows what baseball is going to be like this year? So let's not throw up the white flag just yet. And the Cubs are. They're just giving up on the team before even the fans do.
I mean, as a Cardinals fan, I love it. It looks like it will be the worst division in baseball, and which the path is wide open for the Cardinals, and they're not even very good or set to be very good next year. They could make one trade or one signing, and they would be immediately like a number one lock. So I love that. I think this is like a return to form for the Cubs, and that wasn't kind of the common knowledge for decades, that because they were able to fill Wrigley Field or sell tickets regardless of the quality of the team, there was no incentive to invest in the quality players, right? And so if next year is like, you know, tickets are off the table or you're not going to be playing half the season, maybe you just, you know, use it as a rebuilding year because there's not going to be any financial consequences.
Right.
Lisa,
yeah.
Did you grow up a White Sox fan, or did you have? Well, you were in Nebraska, right? Was your family?
That happened, Lisa.
No, I didn't Royals grow up, or what? When I got here, I was. Yeah.
And I'm a convert. I abandoned the Cubs 2 years ago, and I'm all in for the White Sox.
That was about the marquee deal for you, right?
It was about the marquee deal. It was about the Ricketts. Yeah.
Who is the Nebraska baseball, like, who would most Nebraskans go with?
The Kansas City Royals.
Royals. Okay.
Yeah.
The University of Nebraska. Like, that's a big college baseball town, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and they were hot and cold. They were really good when I was a teenager, and then go off to college at the University of Nebraska, and then they were terrible. Like, you could just be, I mean, there were tickets laying on the ground to go in and see those games.
I still had the idea, Eric, that the White Sox should do a, this is the TV commercial for me. You get a bus. You drive it around Wrigley Field. You see the bus driving around Wrigley Field, and there's some beloved White Sox guy. Maybe it's Eric Zorn, the columnist, saying, come on, get on the bus. And then they drive the bus to the South Side, literally picking up Cub fans as they go, because I think a lot of Cub fans are looking for a team, and they got what's going to be a very entertaining team on the South Side this year. They're not even on my radio station anymore, but damn, that's going to be a fun team to watch. And I, if I were the White Sox, I would say, hey, come on, let's go. You're pissed at this team? We got one you don't even know, but you could very easily love on the South Side.
Yes, the White Sox, not the white flag.
There you go. There's the tagline. The Anjanette Young story dominated our conversation last week. I just want to touch bases on it, in that not a lot has happened since. Anjanette Young's attorney was going to meet with Lori Lightfoot, and the kibosh got put on that maybe by her attorney. He said he doesn't think that Lori Lightfoot wants to meet, or he wanted to hold a forum and the mayor wasn't comfortable with it. Heather, is there anything else we need to know relative to that story as it sort of unfolds this week?
I mean, that's the long and the short of it, I think. I would say that you know, unless Lisa has gotten a present in her email that I haven't gotten, we're still waiting for the mayor to fulfill her promise to give us the emails that show she was notified about the raid and the request filed by Anjanette Young's lawyer for the video. We haven't seen those emails yet, and I sort of half expect them to come at, 4:30 tomorrow on New Year's Eve.
We were just talking about that. Not that, but like, I'm always waiting, a day or two, or especially on a sort of bookending holidays for some kind of a data dump or some kind of a response to a FOIA that's going to make somebody look really bad. For those to sort of be issued by the city hall, state house or somebody, just so that the news is kind of buried, right? People aren't paying attention. They may be more so now because people are kind of staying put more so, but I think these elected leaders like to get this stuff out on a Friday night or as I said, between bookended holidays so that maybe people aren't paying attention.
It doesn't this is developing a ripe odor, this failure of the Lightfoot administration to let these emails out. Because we were talking about, it was at least a week ago on this podcast, maybe it was before that where we were talking about, I'm willing to withhold judgment on how Lightfoot handled this a year ago until I see those emails. Because if those emails were just like, here's a list of, six cases and name, date, place, nothing. If there was nothing in there about what makes this case so appalling, the nakedness of Anjanette Young and the indifference that the police officers showed. If this was just on a laundry list that was given to the mayor, she went, yeah, let's deal with that. But if those emails are more damning, then if they say, look, this is what happened, this is what you saw on these videos, this is horrible, and she just went, yeah, and now she's telling us she didn't know about it. That's not plausible. That's really, really a problem for the mayor. And the fact that we haven't seen those emails in at least a week, it tells me that there's something in there that they really don't want us to see.
One thing that she can be rightly criticized for now, regardless of what the emails say, and something we actually didn't get into too much last week, is the appointment of this special investigator and sort of bringing in of Jones Day, this outside law firm. And the Tribune wrote a great editorial board, had a great editorial on this, which the essential point was this: that investigator is essentially reporting to the city law department and almost even reporting to the mayor in a sense. And those should be the main subjects of the investigation that they're conducting. I know they're doing it pro bono. There's not a cost associated with it that we're paying. But that's a real problem in terms of the chain of command. And the preferable authority to actually independently investigate this is the Inspector General's office. And many aldermen have been calling on Inspector General Joe Ferguson to open up an investigation with this. I think he's probably taken the right move, which is to kind of collect himself, see what the special investigator does, see what city council does. But I think this could end up being a massive rift between city council and Lightfoot on a scale that we have not seen before, specifically this issue, who's investigating, and then what is the police reform that's coming on the back of this.
Yeah, imagine
that'll be a huge story.
Imagine if Kim Fox had said, I'm going to investigate this Jussie Smollett case by appointing a friend of mine to run the investigation. This is not to impugn Judge Williams' integrity or independence, but it just it just looks terrible. And you have Joe Ferguson, who I'm a fan of Joe Ferguson, so I admit it. I think he's got integrity. I think he's got a good track record. He's the guy who should be investigating this case. He's the guy who should be taking a look at what Lightfoot knew when she knew it, what the police department knew, what they didn't know, what they should have done. All that should be going on, but it should not be happening with someone who reports to the mayor. That is another misstep in this case.
About that meeting that the attorney for Anjanette Young was going to have with the mayor, I don't think it was a bad idea to not have that.
No, I mean, it's clear that Anjanette Young's attorney wanted a public event, and the mayor was not willing to participate in that. And I think what the issue also was that also the Keenan Salter, the lawyer who is potentially facing sanctions from a federal judge for releasing the tape to CBS2, also ended up inviting all of the aldermen. And that gave the mayor the ability to say, well, wait a minute, what about COVID? What about the Open Meetings Act? He sort of opened the door for her to sort of, say, I don't want to do this in the first place. And now here are some reasons that I don't want, that makes sense. It's a fraught situation. I mean, the city council hearing on this a couple days before Christmas went almost 8 hours. And it's really, it would be hard for me to overstate the anger from so many aldermen about this situation and how left out of the loop on this they felt. And to Austin's point about a rift between the city council and the mayors, you know, my question is, you know, how much bigger can it get? There's not a lot of love and, you know, sort of mutual admiration there. The budget process was very bruising for a lot of aldermen. You know, I think the mayor also sort of came out of that sort of angry in a lot of different ways that probably played into her response about the raid and its aftermath. But I think, you know, not that we're looking ahead to 2021 because my crystal ball, unfortunately, is broken, Eric. You know, there's no doubt that the mayor's relationship with the city council, it faces a lot of challenges and a lot of pressure points.
Yeah. Lisa, were you or Austin going to chime in on that before we click on?
No, I just it's very clear that relationship. I'm trying to figure out who her touchstones on city council are anymore, because she's bombed out quite a few bridges, and I just don't know. I really think it's already pretty icy for her. I don't know what between sort of what happened with the Anjanette Young case and her relationship with counsel. I don't know what gets her back on track, because she needs them, you know, despite sort of her criticism coming into office, at some point she does need them politically too, to, you know, she has any kind of future to run for office or to get any of her agenda and the balance of her 2 years left accomplished.
Day one, she served notice that there's a new sheriff in town.
Well, speaking of sheriffs, it seems to me that a big story of the coming year, and I don't know how to quantify it exactly, but it's going to be the mayor's relationship with the police department and the related crime issues that are going on. We're going to see approximately 800 homicides in Chicago, which is up, I don't know what the percentage is. Heather probably knows, but it's
I think it's up 50%.
It's up 50%.
When we had a new superintendent who said he was going to try to hold it to 300. And so there's a real feeling, I think, among people that things are out of control. Carjackings are way up.
Yeah.
And you've just got all, there's this feeling like things are not under control. The mayor's got a really fraught relationship with the police union right now. This Anjanette Young story plays into that in some ways. It's like it creates friction and anger. If any of you ever look at that, like Second City Cop and some of the cop blogs, and you know the hatred they have for the mayor and for her handling of these things is really palpable. And what happens to the crime rates in Chicago, what happens to the homicide rate, and what happens to Superintendent Brown? All those things seem like big stories in the coming year. What will Mayor Lightfoot get control of the city, where it feels to me like things are not in control right now as a resident?
And not to mention the fact that the Chicago Police Board is going to have to decide whether to fire the president of the Fraternal Order of Police for blatantly racist, misogynistic, and anti-Muslim Facebook posts. I mean, like, that can't get any more fraught. Like, it's just max.
There's a consent decree too, right?
I mean, right. Oh yeah, there's that.
Oh yeah, that.
Do the street report officers in Chicago like the head of their union?
I mean, that is one of the $64,000 questions that I don't know the answer to. I mean, he clearly had enough support to win the election,
because he strikes me as the kind of guy that I would be a little embarrassed by. I don't think he serves the image of the Chicago police well.
Oh, of course not. But I think the reason for his victory is a very Trumpian reason, which is they're not assessing this guy's character per se, or his past behavior, or his professionalism as a police officer, or his competence. It's more about he fights the right people and he pisses the right people off. Mm-hmm. And a lot of police officers hate the mayor's office in the way that they feel they've been disrespected by the mayor's office. And I think the ideal way to break this logjam is you Lightfoot goes to Springfield and says, I need help and I need reform on the collective bargaining rules that force me to make compromises and make ridiculous deals with guys like this. And I think that would do wonders, but the odds of that are very slim.
Speaking of doing deals, let's talk a little bit about Mitch McConnell's power in the United States Senate. A $2,000 stimulus check would go out to millions of Americans if the president had his way, and if the House of Representatives has its way, and who knows, maybe even if the Senate had its way. But Mitch McConnell isn't going to allow that. He's attached a couple of poison pills to a bill that would give everybody $2,000, but it's so unpalatable, it's not going to happen. It's amazing, right? Like, I understand what the role of the president is, the chief executive, and maybe that office has too much power. But look how much power Mitch McConnell has. And I don't know what your general thoughts are about $2,000 going to Americans. I'm okay with it. It's not perfect, but I'm okay with it. We're not giving people $1 million. We're giving them $2,000 lousy dollars. We're not even going to do that. We're going to give them $600. It's laughable. So that's not a question, but Eric, what's your first thought about Mitch McConnell this week?
Well, my thought, I don't know what his long game is. I can't really read his long game because clearly right now he's very interested in winning these Georgia Senate runoff elections. There's two of them. They're January 5th, which is what, a week from yesterday. And he needs to get those Republican voters excited about a Republican Senate. And I don't think this is doing it. But again, this is, I'm playing one-dimensional chess here, thinking about how this will play. The money, obviously, this is not a party that has worried for the last 4 years about debts and deficits. So I'm not exactly sure what the problem with the $2,000 is as a just a symbolic or a grand gesture. I should say it's more than symbolic, clearly, but as something that really shows how concerned the government is. So I can't really read his long game. I'm curious what other people on the panel think, because I'm baffled by it as a political matter. Forget the economics of it.
Can I make an educated guess?
Please.
So if you look back at what happened after Obama took office, after George W. Bush, you saw the Republicans, and to be honest, most Democrats, pivot hard to sort of deficit reduction and sort of, you know, being careful with the public purse and not, you know, sort of increasing spending. And I think that Mitch McConnell had planned all along to try to execute a similar sort of pivot to deficit reduction and, you know, sort of being concerned about spending. And I think that is very complicated now by the fact that you have the president calling for these $2,000 checks, as well as the two Republican candidates in the Georgia Senate runoffs, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler. And I think that, you know, I think that Mitch McConnell is betting that his long game, you know, that served him not badly during the Obama years, is what would serve him best in the long term under a Biden administration. Because, you know, Biden has a track record of sort of being reluctant to spend in sort of that sort of middle of the road Democrat sort of way. And I think that McConnell sort of saw that as what his path would be before it sort of got blown up by the president's Christmas reluctance to sign the relief package.
Can he wait till January 6th to do this? I mean, if I'm a Republican thinking about trying to hang on to these seats, there are a lot of voters down in Georgia who are going to say, well, which party is keeping this money out of my pocket? It's the Republicans. And I, you know, all these long-term thoughts about deficits and debt reduction, fine. But we're talking about people who need money now. I don't get it.
You can make an argument that McConnell believes that the Republicans are favored in the runoffs because the Republicans have won runoffs in Georgia since they were created to, you know, bolster white power in the face of a growing black electorate.
Well, I would guess that the Republicans will retain their seats, at least one of them, maybe both of them. But if Donald Trump had won re-election, I'll bet McConnell is singing a different tune right now. Eric, you had some things that you wanted to...
We talked about COVID already, and we also talked about Mayor Lightfoot and the relationship with the police, which I think are two of the big stories of the last year that are going to really spill over into the next year. And the third one, of course, is Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House, veteran Speaker of the House, and what's going to happen with him. Right now, there are 19 members of his caucus who said they're not going to vote for him for Speaker. He's six short. Flag me if I'm getting any of these numbers wrong. He's six short of the number that he's going to need to be reelected Speaker. There doesn't seem to be any really strong candidate emerging yet to take that role. And so the House is going to have to vote when the House comes back in, I believe, what, in a week or two? When do they reconvene?
They're going to vote on it the 14th, I believe.
14th. That's a really big question mark, because if Madigan loses his power, who takes over? Who helps draw the maps? All that stuff. That is a huge political story coming up. And the fact that he seems to be in the Fed's crosshairs. And he may be indicted by the end of the year, which doesn't mean that obviously we can see from the city council that being indicted by the feds doesn't mean you lose your seat, but it could be a real political liability, which I think Madigan has become for the Democrats. One of the other things that I think we saw last year was that Madigan dragged down Democrats and Democratic ideas around the state that I don't know. I think, Austin, did you guys put out a report on where the Fair Tax Amendment did really poorly? And a lot of people said that the fact that Madigan is so unpopular really dragged down that effort, which was led by Governor Pritzker. So
I did an official tweet report last night, and it's the district. The numbers are, there's 74 House districts held by Democrats in Illinois. The Fair Tax lost in 26 of those. Didn't get 50% of the vote. So there's bipartisan rejection. It was also rejected in 37 of the 85 House districts that voted for Biden. So it was by no means just Republicans voting against this thing.
I think it was a lot of those people had listened to our debate, Austin, and found that
that's why I chalk it up to, too. Yeah.
And found that you won, and that they voted against the amendment. So
I didn't think that thing was ever going to pass, Eric.
I let the taxpayers down, or not. I let the wealthy taxpayers.
Are we going to get what's the status of a statewide income tax increase on everybody then?
Well, that's a question. What do you think, Austin? You think it's going to happen?
I'm curious Lisa's opinion also, but those numbers, if there's 26 Democrats looking at how this thing just went down in their districts, how are you getting them on a flat tax hike when their constituents just rejected a hike that was supposed to only be on people who are rich? I think that'll be very, very difficult. And there's not that many lame ducks. It's not like in 2011 where there's all these people waiting around to take yes votes on unpopular things.
I mean, I think the issue is that the state's deficit, correct me if I'm wrong here, is almost $4 billion. And there's no way to bridge that with borrowing. And there's no way to bridge that with cuts. So, you know, I am no budget expert, but that leaves really, you know, increasing revenue, and there's really no better, there's no easier way for the state to raise revenue than income tax. And I'm interested, if not an income tax hike, then what, I think is the question that I would be looking to answer in early January.
$1,000 license tabs.
We'll sell starved rock.
Lisa, do you have any insight on the probability of that? Maybe. How about this, Lisa? We tax the rich. Oh, wait, that didn't work. Maybe we tax just certain, like by name, we have a bill that taxes some people. Just call out people we don't like.
Just A through M.
I could help.
M through Z.
Right. I agree with that. I two things. We have very few sort of options in the menu. I mean, Heather, I think you hit it. There are few options right now to go to the well for. So I think it's a given that it's going to happen. I don't know if it's sort of in combination that the Republicans get something that they want. That seems to always sort of be some kind of pot sweetener, or if it's sort of a, we're going to raise the income tax for 5 years and then it goes away after six. I don't know, but I just don't see where else they can go. I don't see what other well they can go to. I've already suggested that that somebody start patrolling Lakeshore Drive and ticketing people. We could solve the pension problems, the other deficit problems, and nobody listens to me. So that's,
you know, I brought that comment of yours up to my wife the other day when we were going down Lakeshore Drive, which should keep its name, by the way. I said, Lisa is right. These people are insane. I mean, people are doing 80 weaving on a street with curves and a 40 mile an hour speed limit.
Yes. I realized I was counting to keep up with traffic. I have been by my father. It was raised again in this because my dad was the one who taught me to drive. And by this group, I recognize that. But to keep up with people like on a Saturday morning would require me to go 60 miles an hour, which I just won't do.
This is a result of the pandemic. There are so fewer people on, especially the expressways around the city.
Yeah.
Get on the Eisenhower sometime and you'll see some crafty driving. I mean, because people just roar down these streets because they can. There's a few of us in the way, but they can get around them. And it's amazing. Sometimes I have not seen some spectacular crashes. I keep thinking, okay, here comes one. I'm finally going to see somebody get airborne. Never happens. Why do I sound disappointed?
It's a really amazing statistic that we've had more traffic fatalities this year, even though everybody is ostensibly locked inside, than we had in previous years. That people are driving a lot worse. I think Lisa's observation is exactly right.
Eric, give us some of your things that you are going to make predictions on, and we'll decide if we're interested.
Well, the first question, I did a predict the news poll. It's already closed, and my column has already been written for Sunday, which I give the results of this poll. But I asked people, what do they expect in the next 20 days? What do you expect Donald Trump to do in the next 20 days? Is he going to pardon himself? Is he going to pardon his family? Is he going to announce his run for presidency? Is he going to appoint special counsels to investigate Hunter Biden? Is he going to conduct a mock inauguration ceremony? Any ideas on the table here?
I like your last one. I don't think he's going to pardon himself. I don't think he's going to pardon members of his own family, because that would be beneath the dignity of the office. And I'm going to give I'm going to give him one last chance. Yes, I do think he's going to have some concurrent mock ceremony. I don't know that it'll be an inauguration, but it'll be some sort of protest rally on Inauguration Day. I don't know if that's too vague for you, but that's what I got.
He did release a video the other day showing a Nobel Peace Prize superimposed over his some news conference that he had. So he's not above mock ceremonies and so on. So,
Lisa, you got a 20-day prediction?
I don't. I do think that there will be at least a few sort of out of left field things that we can't predict, because that has been he's going to do that until January 19th at midnight, I think, you know. So I don't think there's any way to predict. I think we'll have some weirdness, though. But I do believe that there will be some kind of event. I don't know if it's a protest or a rally or whatever. I was just more thinking it's some kind of a coming down from some elevator at the very time that Joe Biden is being sworn in to announce that he's going to be
up the escalator, up the golden escalator,
up the golden escalator,
and out with Melania.
The thing that I didn't ask about that I'm actually concerned, worried, and about is violence. There seems to be a lot of anger out there among Trump supporters. There is this call to rally in Washington next Wednesday, a week from Wednesday, when Congress is supposed to certify the results of the Electoral College vote. I worry that someone's going to be killed. I really do. I didn't ask this as a question, but does anyone else share my concern that this is like, it's not just people snapping at each other on social media, but this could actually spill over into actual violence?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think January 6th is going to be a very tense day in Washington. You know, the president just tweeted, "See you in D.C. on January 6th. And, you know, it's not as if, you know, he is directly advocating violence. But if you're somebody who's sort of enmeshed in the QAnon world, you hear that as a call to violence, even if it isn't an explicit acknowledgement of it. And, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of collateral damage along the way, even if no major violence erupts. You know, there's the tale of the Harrington Hotel in Washington, D.C., which, you know, is a venerable sort of hostel where the Proud Boys had sort of made their headquarters. They had to close for 3 days around the 6th because so many of the Proud Boys had sort of made reservations and they were afraid of being sort of the epicenter of something happening out. So, you know, yeah. that business is suffering. There will be others, and there will, you know, there'll be other damage sort of caused along the way.
I think the real danger for violence would be if somehow Joe Biden were denied the presidency. Then you would see violence in the streets. Then, you know, I'm going to be a little more optimistic than you guys have been, though.
Well, we're definitely going to see violence. The question is, are we going to see deadly violence? That's right.
Really?
I mean, there was already violence when Trump supporters gathered in Washington a few weeks ago. There were fist fights. I think somebody got knifed.
Well, I'll allow you some fist fights, but something endemic, something widespread, something really catastrophic. I don't know, Eric. I think they point the cameras in small crowds sometimes and make it look bigger than it is. I'm going to opt for nothing too sensational.
Okay, here's another question from my survey that I just want the opinion of the table on is, what do you think is going to happen with Rep. Adam Kinzinger? He's the Republican who represents a district that kind of circles Chicago far out in the exurbs. He's been outspoken against President Trump. Very nice profile of him in the Tribune yesterday by Rick Pearson. I did a column on him. A lot of people have been praising him. And there's talk that he may run. What do you think, governor? You think he's going to run for Senate? Or you think he's just going to stay put and fight off a primary challenge engineered by Trump? What do you think what's going to happen with Kinzinger?
Well, he's going to get mapped out of his district, or his district's going to change significantly after the census. So you would think someone of his stature and the moves that he's made would be considering run for statewide office. I think his chances of winning a Senate seat that's a tough road for, I mean, any Illinois Republican to do that. I think Pritzker's going to be weak, and I think he has the best shot of anyone being considered to beat Pritzker in a head-to-head gubernatorial race. Now, the question is, can he get out of a primary if someone like a Darren Bailey or someone else, really outspoken person on the right, tries to nail him for some of his remarks against Trump, which have sort of almost continued to escalate. He's kind of getting more confident in doing that over the last few weeks, which might bite him in a gubernatorial primary.
If you got like a Jeannie Ives running against him somewhere.
Or a Darren LaHood.
But if you get sort of some of the, because he's really trying to circle back on this message, and I think this is what Mitch McConnell is actually trying to do too, that let's get back to our Republican roots of conservatism, that, you know, hey, we're not Trump Republicans. We are, you know, we're conservatives. And I think if you start hammering away at that as sort of, I'm the normal Republican and can kind of sort of separate yourself from sort of maybe people who are more Trump supporters, I think you could get, I think you could get the backing of some pretty deep pocketed, Republicans out there. Sort of the Ken Griffins of the world, folks like that. And so I don't know. I would think that he'd be able to stand up to sort of somebody like, you know, maybe a Darren Bailey or a Jeannie Ives.
I mean, this is the fundamental question facing the Republican Party in 2021 and further. Is there a lane for an anti-Trump Republican to win statewide? And I don't know that there is, because, you know, certainly there's a group of moderate Republicans out there that would be willing to vote for Adam Kinzinger. But how many of them are there, and do they outnumber in a primary people who want to vote for somebody like Darren Bailey or Jeannie Ives? And I don't know the answer to that question. It will be absolutely fascinating to see it, to see that question. And you know, I don't know that Governor Pritzker is going to be weakened when he does run for re-election. I think that he will point to, you know, assuming that the vaccine distribution stays, you know, among the best of all of the states, I think he will point to that. I think he will point to the fact that as of right now, the pandemic never reached the heights that it did in New York or California. I think he has an argument to be made. And if you're not going to vote for Pritzker because of the way that he handled COVID, I don't know that you want to vote for somebody like Adam Kinzinger. And that, I think, is the fundamental question that I'm fascinated to learn.
Yeah,
you have to sort of look to that Kinzinger has been able to kind of ride the line. I know everyone wants to say, oh, you know, he's the only Republican that has talked back and pushed back. He's pushed back at the rhetoric. Okay. He voted with Trump on legislation something like 95% of the time. And so he's going to be able to sort of ride that line and split the difference. He's a decent orator. He makes the rounds all the time on cable news. They love him.
Yeah.
And so I think that he could definitely make this case where, like, okay, well, you know, he could trot out that record. It's out there. 538 has that record, you know?
Yeah.
So he is not sort of this, you know, never Trump or anti-Trump. I know that that's sort of this sort of new conventional wisdom, but it's just not the case.
Well, I think what he's saying to conservatives and Republicans is what I think a lot of them are saying to themselves, which is, I like a lot of Trump's positions, but I don't like his style. I don't like his attitude. I don't like some of the things that he's done. I don't like his tweets. You hear that a lot. So if you have someone who says, like, look, politically, I'm pretty much there for him. I think it's in the last Congress, it was more like in the mid 80s where Kinzinger was with Trump, but enough. You know, he's not a rhino. So he's going to be able to position himself as a conservative Republican who just differed with Donald Trump on style and on certain points, where I think a lot of Republicans really are. I mean, I think that if you're Jeannie Ives trying to make the difference between him and yourself, and you say, well, you know, I loved all his tweets. I loved the way he fought for the election and threatened chaos. I don't know that flies with Illinois Republicans. I mean, they elected Bruce Rauner, remember.
His pitch in the primary will be, I can beat Pritzker. That's the best argument he has going for him. So that's the question. If Heather, I think your point's spot on, like, how many anti-Pritzker voters are pro-Kinzinger? I think that will be the argument that he'll have to make if he chooses to run.
And I think we've seen time and again that Republicans are not willing to sort of parse that difference between he voted with the president. If somebody like Kinzinger is out there blasting the president, which he absolutely has been. And I think that sort of, you know, so much of what we've heard from Republicans is just this desire to sort of march in lockstep with the president, especially on a place like Twitter, especially on CNN, especially on MSNBC. But, you know, if I'm Jeannie Ives and I want to run for governor again, I just queue up those tweets about, you know, blasting Trump, and I play them over and over and over again. And, you know, if you consider yourself a Trump Republican, I don't know how you vote for somebody like Adam Kinzinger. And I don't know how many non-Trump Republicans are left in Illinois, to be quite honest with you. So that's why I'm fascinated by this.
Really? So if you said there's two kinds of Republicans in Illinois, those that are Trump Republicans and those that are the other kind of Republicans, there's more of which?
There's absolutely more Trump Republicans. That's how
in Illinois.
In Illinois. That's how Jeannie Ives came within a hair's breadth of beating Bruce Rauner, even though Bruce Rauner had millions of dollars at his disposal, and she had basically two quarters to run her campaign.
I hear you, Heather, but I mean, really?
Yeah.
Do you guys agree with that? I mean,
no.
Why?
I think there were other things going on. Bruce Rauner couldn't get anything done. And he got himself hemmed in. He thought he could stand up to Mike Madigan, and he couldn't. And he got nothing done. And everybody abandoned him. It was sort of like, okay, I mean, this guy can't get it done. We need somebody to pull us out of this, or everybody's going to leave Illinois. Everybody's going to move. You know, every rich guy and gal is going to like load up their trailer and leave, because that's always the threat. And so I think Rauner thought he could sort of operate on his own, that he didn't have to make friends. And that became apparent to the people who write the big checks, and they moved on.
Right. But Jeannie Ives put out the most transphobic and.
Oh, I understand that. I'm not saying I understand all of that. But I think at that time, yeah, that's who people were who may have pivoted toward. But I just don't know in this new era whether that I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure that I hear so much disgust with Trump and that they're glad he's gone. And these are people who I talk to who are Republicans that I don't know. I don't know if that works. They were disgusted with her too, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know either, but that's why this is going to be fascinating. And I think Adam Kinzinger has set himself up as sort of like the test case of whether there's a centrist lane in the Republican Party left.
Yeah.
Austin, what's your answer to that? Is there a centrist lane? Is there something in between?
I think Illinoisans historically have always been amenable to Republicans who focus on economic rather than social issues. And I don't think that's changed too much. And kind of the Ives campaign for Congress is kind of an interesting example of that, because the district she ran in, it's not like she was pounding a pro-Trump message necessarily in her campaign, because she realized that people in that district were not that interested in a Trumpian kind of vision for the country. So I do think there is a lane for somebody like that in Illinois politics, and there traditionally has been for Republicans.
Erica, we're kind of went on a tangent there, but throw a couple more at us, my friend.
The one last one I wanted to ask is, there are two things that I'm wondering are whether we think there's going to be groundbreaking on this year. One is the Obama Presidential Center, and the other is a Chicago casino.
No and no.
Nope.
I mean, even the Obama Foundation says, like, even if they got the final approval tomorrow, they wouldn't break ground until 2022. So,
because they don't have the money together?
No, it's just, it's a long process. I mean, it's, you know, you can't spend, you know, $500 million at the drop of the hat. There's a lot of, you know.
Speak for yourself.
Boy, it sure would be nice to see a project like that, though, wouldn't it? I mean, man, could we use that?
Yeah.
Eric, so that's a no and no.
Well, I'm thinking that a casino, I think that the financial need is going to be so acute that the mayor will somehow figure out a way to put a shovel into the ground for a casino.
For a casino.
I just don't think things happen that quickly here. And I don't even think you're going to have the sort of the kind of demand and the travel out there until year's end anyway. And I just don't see it sort of having any kind of financial impact. You know, if you're trying to sort of rev things up right now, I understand that maybe 2022, but nothing gets done that quickly around here.
Well, don't you think, though, that the gamblers are crazy, man? I mean, and by that, I mean,
we love them.
That they, I know, I mean, because they want to gamble. I think if you said, hey, there's one over on Navy Pier and there's going to be some available space, they'd buzz on over there pretty dang quick. Maybe you can't get it done in time, but I think there's an appetite for that. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I mean, I think there's going to be a huge argument on the city council about where this casino should go. And I think that there are two competing sort of arguments. One, it should go at a place downtown, Navy Pier, somewhere adjacent to sort of, current tourist meccas. And there are going to be people who argue it should be on the west side, it should be on the south side, and serve as an economic engine for those neighborhoods, which have been, you know, disinvested for years. And I don't think that's an easy sort of, you know, debate to resolve, especially when, we talked about how difficult Mayor Lightfoot is finding it dealing with the city council. So I don't know, like, if she said, okay, let's build a casino in Lawndale, you know, I don't, you know, where does that go? I don't know.
A casino, people lose money at a casino. If you make a casino convenient for people, what you're doing is you're saying, we're just going to hoover the money right out of your pockets more conveniently here than there. If we're going to do that to people, let's do it to tourists and let's do it out by Navy Pier or wherever the hell the tourists are going to be in the future. And putting it in an economically disadvantaged neighborhood, I think is awful. I think that's transparent. That's not economic development. That's not a new tech company or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
That's a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah,
I've been proposing for 2 years to just sell part of McCormick Place and put it in there. You don't need to break ground. Just put it there. No one's using it. It hemorrhages money every single year.
Parking for it. You've got all
parking's there. You got access to downtown. Just put some slot machines in McCormick Place. You're done.
Well, I mean, you could potentially do that at O'Hare. I mean, the license allows for a slot machine sure. there, and they can't, you know, they haven't even figured out how to do that yet. So
but don't you think the downtown hotel industry, I think that they are really hoping and banking on the casino coming there.
Boy, as a stopgap. I mean, on the short term, a casino downtown would sure mm-hmm. help. Lordy, there's nobody here.
The other side of the argument, and this was Rahm Emanuel's argument for why he blocked a casino for 8 years, which was that it would degrade sort of the other tourist attractions, that somebody like me who's got little kids is less likely to go somewhere near a casino because I would be concerned about like degenerates walking around. I don't even know. But like that's going to be the argument that you're going to hear, that you're going to make downtown, if a casino is there, no longer family friendly, and you're going to end up, you know, paying Peter to steal from Paul. I think I messed up that metaphor somewhere along the line.
I get it. But I mean, I spent some time in East Peoria. Have you been to Rosemont? Have you been to some of these places? Joliet? I don't know that it's turned those places into
all lovely places, all great places. We all want to go. Oh my God.
Shut up. Hey, shut up.
Sold.
I got family in those places.
I got friends.
But this is another point for McCormick. It's far enough away from downtown, but still accessible. And those hotels already shuttle people to McCormick all the time downtown.
What else you got, Eric?
I think that'll do it.
You're not going to ask us about the Cubs or the Sox or the Bears going to win the World Series?
Okay, well, let's end with that. Who's going to win the Super Bowl, and which teams are going to make the playoffs in Chicago sports?
Lisa is a resident White Sox fan. Why don't you crow about your White Sox?
Oh, I mean, I love them, but I'm not sure how they'll do. For the last, 20 years, it's a growing season. It's a
rebuilding.
We got a lot of young guys that are great. We just sort of need to get the rhythm. We need to get this, that. Somebody needs to come together, on and on. I'm not sure, but I look forward to a healthy baseball season this year.
I got the White Sox losing the pennant, not making it to the World Series this year, Eric. Okay. Austin, you want to chime in?
I've got White Sox making the playoffs. Tony La Russa, his triumphant return. Also, maybe he could do another chapter of one of the best sports books ever, which is Three Nights in August, his book about just a three-game series in August when he was managing the Cardinals. I don't think the Cubs make the World Series, make the playoffs. Don't think the Bears make the playoffs. Are we just doing baseball or every sport?
Every sport you want.
Blackhawks, I don't know enough about. I don't know the quality of our WNBA team enough to make a prediction there.
The Bears, no. Blackhawks, yes, but not far. The Bulls, no, and the Cubs, yes, but not far. And the White Sox are our hope. Lisa, Heather, any last thoughts about sports in this city?
I will predict that we are entering a drought of championships never before seen in the Chicagoland area, and that it will be all thwarted hopes and dreams from as far as the eye can see.
That's a great note to end on.
Look, that is the kind of 2020 chaotic energy that I am bringing to all of my media appearances from now on.
To a better 2021. Hey, guys, this is our last pod of this year. Thank you for being part of it. And here's to more vigorous, shorter, and more optimistic conversations in 2021.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. ¶¶